Thanks for tuning into Access Utah today. I'm Tom Williams. Anthony Durr's All the Light We Cannot See was one of the most mentioned books in our most recent UPR community book list. You can check that book list out online, upr.org. All the Light We Cannot See was published in May of 2014, and in September of that year, Anthony Durr visited Utah for several events as a part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. While he was in Logan, he dropped by the UPR studios for a fascinating conversation about All the Light We Cannot See and related topics. And we're revisiting that conversation today. Here then is my conversation with Anthony Durr from September of 2014. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Anthony Durr is author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Light We Cannot See. It's a novel about a blind French girl and a German boy whose paths collide in occupied France as they both try to survive the devastation of World War II. Durr says the novel is about the magic of radio. It's about propaganda, a cursed diamond, children in Nazi Germany, puzzles, snails, Natural History Museum in Paris, the magical seaside town of Saint-Malo in France, and the ways in which people, against all odds, try to be kind to one another. He says, referring to the book's title, there are countless invisible stories still buried within World War II. Stories of ordinary children, for example, are the kind of light we do not typically see, and that ultimately the title is intended as a suggestion that we spend too much time focused on only a small slice of the spectrum of possibility. We're going to talk about All the Light We Cannot See and related topics. Anthony Durr, a pleasure to welcome you in.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
You live in Boise, I understand.
Yeah, we live in Boise, and it kind of reminds me a little bit of Logan. It's so pretty this morning, and I'm happy to have that wind coming out of the canyon. It's a lovely place.
So I was asking you before we went on the air, I was curious where we, you know, I read your biography. Grew up in Ohio.
Yep.
And so how'd you end up in Boise?
I grew up in Ohio, and then I went to college at a little school in Maine called Bowdoin College. And around sophomore year, I fell in love with an Idaho girl.
Okay.
And eventually, after graduate school, she got hired back west in Idaho, and we both wanted to get back to the mountains, and we're happy out there.
Well, love's the best reason, right?
Yeah. It's a great place to have kids. And yeah. The other day, somebody's like, why do you live in Idaho? And I was like, well, we have four bedrooms in Boise, and if we lived in Brooklyn, I don't know if we would have one.
Couldn't afford more than one. Well, All the Light We Cannot See, it's getting great buzz, great reviews. It's 10 years in the making.
Yeah,
understand.
10 years ago I had the idea, 2004. I was teaching at Princeton for 1 year and had finished a book, had my notebook open in my lap, searching around for new ideas. And the train seat in front of me, a man was talking on his cell phone. And as we approached New York City, the train starts to go underground and, you know, concrete and steel are slipping overhead. And the train starts to go a little bit into this tunnel, and his call dropped. He was talking about something really important, The Matrix, the movie The Matrix. And he got angry. He got a little frighteningly and unreasonably angry. He was bashing his phone and swearing. And after I finished worrying about my own safety for a second, I started thinking, you know, what he's forgetting, and really maybe what we're all forgetting all the time with these amazing devices in our pockets, is that it's a miracle. You know, he's sending little packets of light at the speed of light, ricocheting between radio towers. That's what cell phone means. You know, cellular technology is little cells, and they're relaying maybe hundreds or even maybe thousands of miles to whoever he's talking to. And, you know, they're communicating instantaneously at the speed of light. And for the history of humans, that was a strange thing. To hear the voice of a stranger, you had to be able to see the stranger, to hear the stranger. And so I started thinking about electromagnetism. And right there on the train, I wrote down the title, All the Light We Cannot See, trying to think about, you know, all the amazing reach of the electromagnetic spectrum and how we're focused on just this tiny little sliver of it, the light we can see.
And of course, that's a, you know, metaphor for awareness as well. There's many other things. So, and then I think you had this image, a boy.
I did.
Trapped, and his only connection is the radio.
Yeah, that's great, Tom. Yeah, the first year, you know, really had no idea what I was doing. Just trying to, usually, you know, projects come to me very shapeless, and this was, you know, just basically like lumps of clay I was playing with. And I just, all I could think of was I had a blind girl reading a story to a boy over a radio, and I conceived of the boy as trapped in some way. He needed that story to get him through a difficult time. And I liked the idea of these invisible waves of light passing through walls, the way our voices are right now, you know, that walls don't matter to them, so that he could hear this story even though he himself corporally, bodily cannot get out. It seemed an important thing. But it was a full year before I even started to understand that might be in World War II and who the children might be.
Right. And a visit to, it's now having read from your book, I want to go to Saint-Malo. We'll talk a little bit about this. But maybe you could flesh out the plot a little bit more so people could, you know, hang their hat on it, so to speak. So you've got this boy. He's growing up in Germany.
Yeah.
His name is Werner.
Yeah.
So tell us about him and tell us about the girl as well.
Sure. And I think I'll just go right to Saint-Malo because that's really the about a year later when I was on book tour in France, that's when I started to realize maybe this is where I should set my book. I was walking around this beautiful walled city. It's in Brittany, and it's right on the English Channel, these emerald in turquoise waters are hitting this old walled city, and I'm walking through with my French editor. And I say rather foolishly, look how old all this stuff is. And he said, well, actually, this city was, I think it was 89% destroyed, significantly destroyed by American bombs at the end of World War II. This was about 2 months after D-Day in August. The Germans had holed up in this old citadel, even as they were pushing through a lot of the Normandy towns and getting towards Paris. This one little stronghold still held out. And then they painstakingly rebuilt the whole city in the 50s, to the point where now a foolish tourist like me has to look really closely to notice that the lichen is a lot older on some buildings and some of the stone is newer. So that's when I thought, okay, that's where I'll have the boy trapped. Here's a story I didn't know anything about, and I wanted to try to research and understand more about it. Mm. So I conceive of the boy as a German boy. His name is Werner, and he's an orphan and grows up in a coal town and is very gifted with electronics and radio. I tried to invest some of my own passions about radio and this magic that I feel about it into him. And then the girl is named Marie, and she grows up in the Natural History Museum in Paris, which is a place I love, and I just thought it would be so fun to try to imagine growing up there. And she's sightless, but she's in many ways a lot braver and more capable person than Werner is. And her father takes good care of her, at least until the war begins and they have to leave Paris. And he is the master of the locks at the museum, so his job is to keep everything under lock and key. And of course, with the Nazis invading Paris in June of 1940, all kinds of valuables had to be shipped out of town, including many things from the Natural History Museum.
Mm. And the father is tasked with, taking this diamond.
Yes, which may or may not be the real diamond. They make
right.
three decoys, and they send them in all different directions. And this was just one of the many very valuable things that were in the museum. The diamond is, of course, invented, but a lot of this stuff is actually very true. And so, yeah, I imagine that he doesn't know, he can't quite tell if this is a fake or a real diamond, and he carries it out of the city with his daughter, and they go to the town of Saint-Malo, where he has an uncle.
Mm. So the diamond is invented, but this is based on real history. The French, as you say, they didn't think that they would be overrun by the Germans, right? They were, I guess, foolishly confident, and so they didn't have much time to get the Mona Lisa, get everything out.
Yeah, well said, Tom. Yeah, I mean, of course, it sounds foolish in one degree, but for almost everybody who was over the age of 30, they remembered the horrors of World War I and thought nobody is going to ever want to repeat that kind of level of destruction. So it really wasn't until maybe three or four weeks before the invasion of Paris that French citizens started to realize, whoa, this might actually happen. The Nazis are coming in, and they're coming very, very quickly. So, imagine, look around you right now in your home, and imagine if you only have 2 or 3 weeks. And in some cases, people really didn't even want to believe until the day before. And you've got to get everything out of there, including your children. And where will you go? And what would you do?
So you've had this idea on the subway. You've gone to Saint-Malo. You know you're going to set this in World War II. So that brings up a whole host of issues, including the Holocaust. You've got to deal with that. We'll get into that later. But you say that, by the way, this is on your website. You have a Q&A there. So referring to the book's title, they're sort of the obvious metaphors, and then you talk about one that's maybe not as obvious. There are countless invisible stories still buried within World War II, stories of ordinary children, for example. That's one thing. Is this something that I guess you knew beforehand or while you're doing research, all these stories that, and some of them need to be told. I guess all of them, ideally, but at least to chip away at it.
Yeah, certainly not something I knew beforehand. I knew very little. In fact, I thought Brittany was in Britain until I got going on, you know, reading about the war. I think, you know, World War II is at this really interesting time where the people for whom it is memory are reducing in number every day. You know, we are losing not only American veterans, but in Europe, you know, people who remember the war are, you know, often in their 90s, and we're losing them very quickly. And we're in danger. I don't know if danger is the right word, but we have to be careful in how we remember all these stories. I think about how my sons, who are 10, have started to learn about the war, and it's often in kind of frightening to me ways, like through video games or through the History Channel, which can be very responsible, but will also occasionally do these really black and white, almost animated narratives of the war, where, you know, German soldiers are dying on all sides, and, you know, triumphant American tanks are rolling into Berlin. And, you know, I think the truth is always a little bit more complicated than that. So my goal here was to try to say, you know, can you empathize with this French girl, somebody we're pretty used to empathizing with, as deeply as maybe a German boy, a German citizen who makes some poor decisions, but also is really, by socioeconomic reasons, by lack of education, really compromised in a lot of ways in terms of how he's able to think about what's right and what's wrong. Mm.
So I guess it is good versus evil. That's kind of how we think of it. It's the stereotype. And in some ways, that's true, right? You know, the Nazis perpetrated the Holocaust. There's no way you can defend any of that. But there are some when you get down, I guess, past the Nazis, for the German citizens like Werner, there are some gradations there.
Of course. Yeah, of course it's good versus evil in many of the narratives. And yeah, there's no denying that. I just think as you get towards the lives of children, you know, it's important to try to think, you know, what was it like to be 10 years old or 12 years old when this government's coming to power? And, you know, I just kept asking myself, would I have had the strength to say, you know, at age 16, say no? And I think, unfortunately, I look in my dark, tortured soul. I don't know if the answer is yes. You know, I don't know if I would have risked my life or risked my family's well-being to say what we're doing is wrong. And, you know, that's terrible. That's a shameful thing. But I think self-preservation is part of a lot of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think probably most of us, if we're honest, we have to admit that there's a possibility we might have just gone along with it and would have been scared. And, you know, what would we have done?
Sure. To a much lesser degree, I wonder what kind of things am I complicitly agreeing with right now? You know, we started airstrikes in Syria yesterday, and, you know, here I am driving on a beautiful sunny day to Utah to talk about my novel. And really, maybe what matters more is I should be in Washington or should be trying somehow to say, you know, is this the right thing? You know, if you're really concerned about making more members of ISIS are dropping bombs on people, is that the best way to, you know, I feel like every person we kill will make three or four more terrorists. And I don't know if violence is necessarily the best remedy for violence. So I don't know. I'm complicit in a lot of things right now. I think maybe many of us are.
Yeah. So do you think we compartmentalize that to protect ourselves?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we can say, hey, I'm still a good person. I love my children, and I'm here. I'm trying to make money to feed my family. And, you know, morally, things are really complicated. But I also am burning a lot of petroleum in my life, and I flew on an airplane on Sunday. And, you know, am I contributing to global warming in ways that will endanger my children's future? And so I think it's hard sometimes to ask yourself these questions. You know, what about my behaviors could I change to make the world a better place? There's always ways we could do better.
Yeah. How do you relate that or score that or you know, juxtapose that with, I think, something that's important to you. I see this strain through interviews and through your writing. That is this sense of wonder that we ought to open our eyes more than we do, you know, and get back to the way we were as children. And, you know, you see the world as many of us do through your children. And I think you, maybe more than a lot of us, try to get back to that and try to be aware of that. So that sense that you're suggesting that we all have, maybe juxtaposed with what we were just talking about, which some of that is not a sense of wonder. We need to be aware of the bad in the world, too, and what we can do to solve that. And it seems like there's maybe a little bit of a clash there.
Yeah, I'm just very interested in what I read and anything that will make me feel more alive and more awake. I just don't want to sleepwalk through my life. And I just feel so blessed that my job allows me to try to pay attention to the things I'm most curious about. So in the case of this book, not just radio, I'm trying to help the reader see what a miracle radio is and how powerful it was in the 30s and 40s, but also snails or light itself. I think about, the miracle of air travel, these things that become kind of mundane and habitual and almost kind of foul to us. You're crammed into a coach and you're, a salesman on your left eating a barbecue sandwich and the person on your right's watching some awful video. And you're like, you forget that you're streaming through the air at 38,000 feet above the earth. And, I think that Louis C.K., the comedian, said, you're like a Greek god right now. You're in a chariot in the sky. And so I think sometimes, I think of my job as a writer is to try to alert us all, my readers, to this, to the beauties, the miracles that are around us, ants, seashells, the formation of streams and rivers. All these things are so interesting the more you look at them. And I think it's important. I don't believe in reincarnation necessarily. I think we have one trip on earth. If you're lucky, you get 80 years here. And why not see as much as you can and be as awake as you can while you're here?
Hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more with Anthony Durr on his beautiful new novel, All the Light We Cannot See. When we come back, I'll continue this theme. We'll ask about something that Anthony Durr quoted in an essay, a story he wrote. I think it's for Condé Nast. This is your trip to the Big Island of Hawaii with your brother. And you quote Louis Gluck, "We look at the world once in childhood, the rest is memory." It's fascinating. Talk about that and much more. We'll get into some of the more of the plots of the novel and have Anthony Durr read from it. More following the break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Anthony Durr. He's author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Light We Cannot See. It's about a blind French girl and a German boy whose paths collide in occupied France as they both try to survive the devastation of World War II. Anthony Durr says that, among many other things, this is a story about the ways in which people, against all odds, try to be kind to one another. He set the story in World War II after a visit to the walled city in Breton of Saint-Malo. And if you read the book, you'll probably want to go. I guess it's accessible, Anthony Durr. You can go and visit.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous city and the great food. And walking the ramparts is my favorite thing. The walls are about three stories high, circle the entire city. And there's a promenade along the top so you can walk, 360 degrees around the whole city. And, the little promontory that it's on is barely attached to the mainland of France just by a little spit of sand. So it's really almost an island. And it's so pretty to look down on the beaches and, nice weather. There's tons of people down there. And the tides are enormous. So sometimes when the tide goes way out, you have acres of beach below. And other times the waves are crushing the walls right below you. It's an amazing place.
So on the ramparts, you can look over and see into the upper stories of some buildings.
Yeah,
too. It's
yeah.
Kind of interesting. Peer into the lives of people.
Yes. My first night there, I saw two women. It was night. And, they're, I think, on the third floor of this tall apartment house. And they're sitting there and they're clinking their wine glasses together. And I'm like, do they even know I'm here? You're quite close to them.
Does something like that go into your notebook? You always
have
a notebook with you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Little things like that. Like the incident on the subway was the genesis for this novel.
Yeah, you got it. That's one of the nice things about being a writer is everything can eventually become material. And especially if you're rested and well-fed, you're often paying attention. And for me, that always ties in with travel. When I leave home, leave the familiar, I start paying more attention to things. And especially if maybe people all around you aren't speaking English, you're a little more heightened too. So I love being able to carry a notebook in foreign cities and pay attention and look at people. And that's true in the mountains too. I feel like anytime I'm away from home and, surrounded by nature, I'm seeing things a little more clearly if I have a notebook. I'm trying to translate experience into language in some way. It helps you pay attention.
I want to get into childhood. You decided to, you had this image of a boy trapped somewhere listening to a radio and hearing a young girl. So I don't know if it was conscious decision, I'm going to write about children, but you ended up writing about children. And so that's presents some difficulties, some advantages.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the book is about innocence lost. I think what's different about this book is that, you know, I'm pairing these two narratives very closely. There are 187 chapters in the book. Many are quite short. And I just move back and forth almost every time, although occasionally this pattern breaks, but almost every time I say, one's Marie, one's Werner, one's Marie, one's Werner, kind of in an A-B alternating structure. So I felt like I was often just spinning two plates, and then I'd go back and forth and try to keep both plates spinning in the reader's mind so that you see these two trajectories move toward each other. But the book is 500 pages long, and they don't intersect until well into the 400s.
Right. By the way, it looks daunting. It has some half 500 pages. But the chapters are short, a lot of white space, and you've said that that's purposeful.
Yeah. You know, I love reading writers like, say, David Foster Wallace or William Gass, who will write really long, chunky paragraphs. Often, sometimes David Foster Wallace's stories are one paragraph all the way through. But when you're tired at night, occasionally you hit, you know, you turn the page and you see another block of uninterrupted text, and you're like, okay, here I go. I got to get my energy up. And I feel like, you know, white space, even just hitting return, those are marks of gestures of friendliness to the reader. And I'm asking the reader to do a lot here. My prose tends to be pretty lyrical, so it takes a little energy to get through it. And then I'm asking you to keep these, you know, alternating this ping-ponging effect between the two characters in your mind. So I felt like one way I can relieve the effort that I'm asking the reader to put in is by having a lot of white space. So sure, chapters end and then there's a long break, and then you turn the page and you get to try in a little short chapter once again.
And I think it does work. You know, when I saw the novel, I thought, wow, that's long. Open it up, and I was relieved as a reader that there's short chapters. You go back and forth, a lot of movement.
Good.
I want to talk a little bit about this idea of going back and forth. So you have one chapter, you're learning about Werner, then you go back to Marie, you go back and forth. But when you go to the other chapter, the other character is sort of suspended in your mind. It's an interesting thing your mind does. It keeps that character going in your mind. And as you say, the reader is doing that work to sort of, you know, keep the other character going while you're reading about the second one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a common technique of writers using suspense. You know, the root of the word suspense is pendere, to hang. You know, it's like the word pending. Pendant that hangs around your neck. So yeah, I like to think of that as you launch your character into a certain place and then you leave her hanging there. And as long as you don't leave her for too long, your reader will keep that kind of pendulum swinging in her mind until you go touch the other swinging pendant and then you go back and forth. And there's something nice about that. I think I like reading narratives in which you anticipate how will they intersect and when will they intersect, and that kind of keeps you reading.
Mm. There's something similar with radio. It's, how's that for a segue? Oh, because I want to talk about radio. Unlike television, the listener supplies their own visual imagery, right? There's I think more going on. It's less passive. So I wonder if you talk about that in the context of the 1930s. Werner is growing up. He's discovered a talent for a lot of physical things, but especially for radio. He constructs his own shortwave radio, right?
Right. And what's important about that in terms of the novels, in 1937, it became illegal to listen to foreign broadcasts in Germany. So the fact that he's able to repair and manipulate radios enables him to receive broadcasts that maybe the government doesn't necessarily want him to be hearing. And it's not necessarily a political thing for Werner. He's just a boy, but he and his sister start tuning into broadcasts by a Frenchman because they can speak French. And they hear broadcasts about science. And it really is the first time somebody's spoken to the things Werner's most deeply interested in, you know. So meanwhile, his sister might, you learn later, she might be listening to news broadcasts from the BBC and from France. But Werner's mostly interested because he's learning, you know, boys in that town where he grew up had to go work in the mines at age 15. So he's learning maybe there's another path in my life than the one that claimed his father's life, which is the coal mine.
Yeah. It's interesting what they're listening to in French, and there's some interesting revelations about who this gentleman is who's talking. But he's talking about this theory that your brain can create light, right, which is very interesting to your theme.
Yeah, yeah,
but
of course.
And a very interesting idea.
Yeah, our brains are trapped in total darkness, right? There's no windows into your skull, and yet they create for us, you know, of a world full of brimming with color and light. It's just a little paradox, but it's fun to think about. You know, how does the brain do that?
So radio, of course, is very important. And as you say, we've a lot of us have lost that sense of magic, that this disembodied voice from wherever. It could be around the world, in the case of ham radio, is talking to you from a distant point. It must have been when it first came out. Everybody must have had that sense of magic.
Yeah. I mean, 30s and 40s are really even late for that kind of magic. But I think the power it would have over a child, especially Werner, who's so isolated in this coal mining town and really just getting one version of the truth pumped into him, this megalomaniacal nationalism pumped into his head from, state broadcasting, the idea that he might be able to hear other voices murmuring underneath that, and that voices are invisibly streaking over his town just like they are here, is an amazing thing. It's hard for us to put ourselves back in that place because the internet has become all powerful, and rightly so. It's an amazing technology. But, if you try to remember how many generations of humans lived with really almost no long-distance communication. There's interesting studies about Nigerian drums and how they were used to transmit news over long distances, or even, the Greek centuries lighting one torch on a mountaintop and then another torch. But in terms of the sophistication of the messages that were sent, it wasn't until the 20th century that we could send complicated messages a long way.
Now I'm thinking about semaphores. And I've gone to Monty Python there, Jane Eyre in Semaphore. But so when it came to electronic means, this must have been just seemed like a huge leap
sure,
forward.
Sure, of course.
So at some point, I like this detail, Werner encounters a man comes to see him. I guess his fame has grown. He has this ability. A man smelling of cake, which is important. Because, Werner's a poor boy. Cake's
and
a great luxury.
Whipped cream is forbidden at that point, yep.
And they want him to go and fix the radio for, a rich person. That's how he gets involved.
A mining official. Somebody with ties to the Nazi party. Yeah, and he faces this gorgeous radio, something he's never seen before, and he gets to crawl in the back of it. And he realizes that really it wasn't a very complicated fix at all, and that's a couple adults who were trying to fix the radio have missed it. And so, he fixes the radio, and that brings him to the attention of this man because he's just a boy. He's 14 at that point. And he says, I can help you find a way out of the mines. I know these schools, these elite schools for the quote-unquote racially elite, where you can go and learn, rocket propulsion and all the latest technologies. And Werner says yes, even though he'll leave his sister behind. And she can already intuit that maybe this isn't going to be everything that Werner thinks it will be.
Yeah. Which is the case, I guess, for just about anybody in the war.
Yes, especially Germany.
Especially in Germany, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he goes to the school, and there's an interesting, struggle for his soul. He's being used, essentially.
Yes, all these boys were really in heinous ways. I mean, teaching them horrific levels of racism and also conditioning them to become brutal machines, really ruthless. Some of the research about these schools was really harrowing for me. Part of the reason the book took me so long is that a lot of the research, really the whole Eastern Front and the scale of human destruction along the Eastern Front, so harrowing that, and then of course the Holocaust, that sometimes I would have to take month-long breaks and try to write other things.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the Holocaust. I've read you in other interviews. I guess you have to decide if you're going to write about World War II, you got to deal with the Holocaust somehow. So either do a Holocaust story, but it has to appear somewhere, right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you hope our, at least for American readers, you hope our public schools have done a good enough job that your reader will have it in her mind at the bottom of her understanding as she reads. But, of course, you can't ignore it. And I worried so much about cliche. There's no way I can tell a Holocaust story as well as a survivor has. It's Primo Levi or Anne Frank. You can't touch. These are classics of literature. So my solution was to haunt the book with the Holocaust and have it kind of run underneath, mostly unspoken, run it underneath the narrative. But there are times when it surfaces. There's a... the diamond we mentioned early in the interview that Marie's father may or may not be carrying out of the city. There's a much more stereotypical German hunting that. He's a sergeant major named von Rumpel, and he's searching for this diamond. And at one little chapter, it's less than a page in the book, I have him in Poland, and these things really existed, where he goes into this safe house and he starts sorting through gemstones and ranking them, you know, by their quality, just the way any, you know, gemologist would be sorting stones now. And, you know, he wonders, where did all these things come from? And, you know, I'm hoping, crossing my fingers, that a reader understands exactly where they have come from.
Right. So I wonder if we talk a little bit more about Werner and this it begins to dawn on him. At a certain level, he realizes that, you know, I'm being used in a bad way. And of course, we're, as the reader, we're pulling for him to, you know, to save some of his soul, at least to, you know, to come out of this. He's a boy. We care about him. He has a friend, Frederick, I think, who I think you've said represents, or, you know, what war can do to the gentle, I guess that's the word for him.
Yeah, a dreamer.
The dreamers. And that's just the wrong time and place for a dreamer, right? Middle of war.
Yeah. Frederick's really, in many ways, I drew inspiration for him from one of my sons. Frederick is in love with birds, and it's really important to his parents for their social standing that he goes to the same school that we've been talking about, these Napola schools that Werner goes to. And, you know, they assume be in training to become an elite member of their party, but Frederick is not the right kind of boy. So I just tried to wonder, you know, I think about bullying, I think about the way my son is sometimes different than some of his classmates, and, you know, they're not rude to him in the way Frederick's classmates are by any means, but he is just kind of a different kind of kid, and you know, there just wasn't room for that. This is just a brutal time and a place for a kid like that.
Yeah.
The whole point of these exercises is to ferret out the weakest in these schools. And, you know, they're trying to tighten the core and make them all moving in the same direction. They said, you know, you're the blade at the tip of the spear of the Reich. You know, all these really creepy things. And, you know, of course, that meant boys were getting pushed out all the time.
And Werner, interestingly, I guess when he goes to the school, they measure the blondness of his hair, right?
Sure, they measured everything. None of that's made up. Yeah, they quantify how blue your eyes are, you know, even the shape of your head, this creepy phrenology stuff where they're trying to find the perfect race, you know. Stuff is very awful.
Yeah, that it's just horrible to contemplate this you know, trying to shape humanity.
Yeah.
You're playing God in essence. You're wiping out one race and you're trying to, you know, exalt the Aryan race, and it just doesn't work, and it's horrible.
And it was only 70 years ago, 75
yeah.
years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah, and continues in some cases. You know, you think about Bosnia and other places. We have an email. This is from Steve in Arizona. Steve says, by coincidence, I happen to be reading When Paris Went Dark, a historical account of the German occupation of Paris that I imagine your guest may also have read. Your guest this morning uses the phrase, the invasion of Paris, which Ronald Rosbottom, author of When Paris Went Dark, never uses because Paris was undefended. Effectively, the French invited the Germans into the city and never fired a single shot in its defense, to the considerable chagrin of many. So from Rosbottom's perspective, there never actually was an invasion. It was more of an invitation. Many thoughts.
Huh, that's lovely. That's interesting. Yeah, I know I haven't read that book. I think it's a newer book, but I'm not sure. But yeah, I read a lot of books about the occupation of France. In particular, I remember Marianne in Chains, wonderful book. But yes, that's true. They did bomb Paris a couple of times in the run-up. But yeah, at that point, they had already broken the back of the French military, and the Germans walked right in. Yeah. And you know, I love some of the descriptions you see. Like, their uniforms aren't even dirty, and they have carnations pinned to their lapels. I remember reading about one German soldier who was just walking a beagle on a leash, you know, as they arrived in Paris. It's yeah, those are really sad and very powerful images.
And then it puts me in mind of the resistance. And you did some, I think, some research. In fact, when the resistance in Saint-Malo. And there again, we get into human nature. Because in the years after the war, everybody was in the resistance, right?
Right.
When the reality was much. And, you know, you and I may not have joined the resistance. You know, there's a lot of fear.
Right, And something I address, or I try to address in the novel, is collaboration. If just by doing nothing, are you a collaborator? Is a tacit complicity just by sitting still somehow? Are you saying I'm complicit in this? Do you have to risk your life to say I'm part of the resistance? And also, you know, I was trying to give Marie, you know, she gets involved in the resistance in an interesting way. I'm trying to say, like, you know, our image of a resistance hero is this, you know, mustached guy in a leather jacket who can make a machine gun out of a paperclip and, you know, ultra resourceful. And yet I tried to say, you know, here's a housekeeper, here's a blind girl who are saying no to this regime in very interesting and kind of subtle and subversive ways.
Mm. Let's take another break. When we come back, I'll have you read chapter 5, I think it is, get into talking about Marie. She's very interesting, and she has an inner strength I think we wish we all had. She's blind, and at the beginning of the book, she's essentially alone, right, in this house, and the bombs are coming. And, you know, full-grown man sighted. You know, who knows whether we would have handled things as well as Marie did or does. More with Anthony Durr following the break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in September of 2014.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. About 10 minutes left. If you would like to join the conversation with Anthony Durr, author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Light We Cannot See, he's in studio with us. You can reach us at upraxis@gmail.com. And All the Light We Cannot See is about a blind French girl and a German boy whose paths collide in occupied France. They both try to survive the devastation of World War II. Durr says, among many other things, this book is about the ways in which people, against all odds, try to be kind to one another. Of course, in this horrible setting. So I want to get into Marie Laure, is her name, and to reset the scene. She has grown up in Paris. She's gone blind fairly early on,
mm-hmm.
And her father is in charge of the locks at the Museum of Natural History.
Yep.
And so at this point, early in the book, they've fled to Saint-Malo. So I'll have you read chapter 5. It's a brief chapter.
Sure. Yeah. So this is the 7th of August, 1944, and this is the beginning of the Allied siege on the city. And in a chapter just before the one I'll read, airplanes have dropped leaflets over the town, and the leaflets say, urgent message to the inhabitants of this town, depart immediately to open country. And so, this is page 5, The Girl. In a corner of the city, inside a tall, narrow house at number 4 Rue Vauberel, on the 6th and highest floor, a sightless 16-year-old named Marie Laure LeBlanc kneels over a low table covered entirely with a model. The model is a miniature of the city she kneels within and contains scale replicas of the hundreds of houses and shops and hotels within its walls. There's the cathedral with its perforated spire and the bulky old Chateau de Saint-Malo, and row after row of seaside mansions studded with chimneys. A slender wooden jetty arcs out from a beach. A delicate reticulated atrium vaults over the seafood market. Minute benches, the smallest no larger than apple seeds, dot the tiny public squares. Marie runs her fingertips along the centimeter-wide parapet crowning the ramparts, drawing an uneven star shape around the entire model. She finds the opening atop the walls where 4 ceremonial cannons point to see Bastion de la Hollande, she whispers, and her fingers walk down a little staircase, Rue des Cordiers, Rue Jacques Cartier. In a corner of the room stand 2 galvanized buckets filled to the rim with water. Fill them up, her great uncle has taught her, whenever you can. The bathtub on the 3rd floor, too. Who knows when the water will go out again? Her fingers travel back to the cathedral spire, south to the gate of Dinan. All evening she has been marching her fingers around the model, waiting for her great uncle, who owns this house, who went out the previous night while she slept, and who has not returned. And now it is night again, another revolution of the clock, and the whole block is quiet, and she cannot sleep. She can hear the bombers when they are 3 miles away, a mounting static, the hum inside a seashell. When she opens the bedroom window, the noise of the airplanes becomes louder. Otherwise, the night is dreadfully silent. No engines, no voices, no clatter, no sirens. No footfalls on the cobbles, not even gulls. Just a high tide, 1 block away, and 6 stories below, lapping at the base of the city walls. And something else, something rattling softly, very close. She eases open the left-hand shutter and runs her fingers up the slats of the right. A sheet of paper has lodged there. She holds it to her nose. It smells of fresh ink, gasoline maybe. The paper is crisp. It has not been outside long. Marie hesitates at the window in her stocking feet, her bedroom behind her, seashells arranged along the top of the armoire, pebbles along the baseboards. Her cane stands in the corner. Her big Braille novel waits face down on the bed. The drone of the airplanes grows.
That's Anthony Durr reading from his novel, All the Light We Cannot See, talking about his character Marie, who's a blind girl. At this point, she's in her teens,
yep.
I think.
She's 16.
I love that image, kind of a sensory image. She smells the ink, so she knows what it is. She can't read it, of course.
Yeah, but she doesn't know what it's telling her to
do.
And they were in such a terrible bind because the Germans had closed all the gates to the city and said, stay in your homes if you're still here. And then the Allies dropped leaflets saying, get out of your homes as quickly as possible.
And then here come the bombers. And this is the Allies, right? They're trying to get the move on with the war, but there's a lot of civilians who are going to be affected.
Yes, of course. And we had, we being the Allies, we had very little concrete intelligence about how many Germans were there. They had re-excavated and really fortified tunnels under the city. And, some intelligence reports said there were only 500, and some said there could be as many as 10,000 Germans holed up there. And they had incredible resources. They had a radio line directly, or a telephone line directly to Berlin. They had water, supposedly enough water that they could last a year. They had all kinds of ammunition. They even had an underground hospital. So, some would say the force was not necessarily, and others would say it was.
Mm. So tell me a little, I have another email question, but I want to, before we go to that, more on Marie. This character Marie, she's a very admirable character. She's very strong, and you're setting this up. She's when the bombs come, she's alone there.
Yeah, she's in an incredibly vulnerable position for much of the novel. She was fun for me to write. I think she has just a very curious soul, and she is lucky to end up with her great uncle Etienne, who's also, even though he's a veteran of the First War and suffers from PTSD and is really afraid of many things, he's also very curious about the natural world, and he teaches her a lot about insects and particularly seashells. Seashells become kind of an outlet for her in a way to escape. And then the other thing is she loves to read, and I loved imagining a time when books were so rare. You know, on my phone, I have probably 20 books on my phone. You know, you can carry the complete works of Shakespeare on an iPad. And this idea that for her, she would just be able to, you know, her family, her father would be able to afford one book a year in Braille, and that these would be her vehicles out of, you know, into imagination and out of difficult circumstances, was really powerful for me.
So writing a blind character, is this a way, it occurs to me this maybe is a way for the reader to try to imagine the world in a different way, because you're putting your place in the place of a blind girl, getting back to that sense of wonder which you feel many of us have lost.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, a lot of my work has to do with trying to break habitualization, the way we become, even if you're eating something delicious like ice cream, by the 20th spoonful, you're not tasting it as keenly as you were on the first one. You know, some of the best candy bars I've ever had are after a two-week backpacking trip, and you come back and you're like, oh my gosh, a Kit Kat is a majestic thing, you know? And I think that's what literature can do for people, is occasionally take you outside of yourself and remind you of all the gifts and pleasures that you have in your life.
Hmm. Here's the email from Amy in Cache Valley. She says, I was moved by the scene between Frederick and Werner when he says, your problem is that you still believe you own your life. Do you believe we ever own our lives?
That's a nice question. Thanks for reading the book. We're in different circumstances. We have just so many more freedoms than those boys did at that time. And I think what Frederick had resigned himself to was saying, I don't have control over what's happening. And what's ironic and special there is eventually they're in this position at the school where they're forced to torture somebody. I won't give too much away, but they're forced to throw water on a prisoner. And Frederick decides he is going to try to own this one part of his life and make a choice and say, this is wrong and I'm not going to do it. And it takes Werner a long time to be able to make that same decision, really almost the entire novel. Mm. So, yes, I do believe that we own our lives despite all these different controls that are put on us. But I think there are these moments sometimes when you can say, you know what, I don't like this job and I'm not going to go today. Or, you know what, today I've saved $500. I'm going to walk into the airport. I'm going to pick a city off the monitor. I'm going to go there. I mean, you know, there are possibilities that we have. And you just have to say, you know what, I'm going to own that today and make a choice.
Just a couple of minutes left. I want to loop back to propaganda. This, you know, you've thought a lot about propaganda. Nazis were masters, and they had a great medium in radio, for example, and you talk about a lot of this with Werner. And I wonder, bringing this forward to today, it's the internet, and one facet of the internet that we think common wisdom is, you know, governments have a lot more trouble getting one message out. On the other hand, we're all fragmented in our own, you know, media silos. What about, you know, the idea of propaganda and control today?
Yeah, I love your phrase, you know, we're fragmented into our media silos. I agree. You know, I worry sometimes that I'm not opening myself up to enough different viewpoints, because you can quickly go through your day and I'll just listen to NPR News and then maybe I'll watch Jon Stewart or something before bed and that's all I've got for that day. And so I think it's really important sometimes to challenge yourself and listen to alternative viewpoints. Yeah, the epigraph in the book, there are two epigraphs, but the second one is from Goebbels, the terrible propaganda minister in the Third Reich. And he says, it would not have been possible for us to take power or to use it in the ways we have without the radio. And maybe about halfway through researching this novel, I read this really interesting paper that tracked the genocide in Rwanda to the power of radio broadcasts, and that it could literally map where certain transmissions were capable of being received, and that's how much of the violence would be occurring. And then once they were outside the range of various radio stations, the violence would taper off. And this idea that these voices, centralized voices, could foment violence is so powerful to me and scary. And so, yeah, I think it's unbelievably vital that the net remains neutral, that we continue to have as many opportunities to hear as many voices as we can. And, you know, if you look at all the tyrannies in the world, often what they're doing is restricting the information that their citizens can receive.
We'll have to leave it there. Much more we could talk about, including I'll encourage listeners to go to Anthony Durr, his website, anthonydurr.com. And there's an interesting article you wrote for Orion, I think, about being disconnected, coming back of a backpacking trip and want to immediately see how many emails you've got, you know, to feel alive. Am I still there? So go and read that. They're very interesting. Maybe on a subsequent visit, we can talk about that. Anthony Durr has been with us. He is author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Light We Cannot See. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. It's fun.
Thanks for listening today. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and hope you enjoyed that conversation from 2014 with Anthony Durr. It's a wonderful book, All the Light We Cannot See. That was featured prominently in our discussion recently, where we compiled our latest UPR community book list. And you can find that book list and listen to that program online at upr.org, as you can with all the Access Utah programs. Thanks for listening today.